Hello, and welcome to What Comes to Mind, Season 2 of The Psychonaut Show. This is John K. Burton, MD, psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and your host on this podcast that brings ideas from the history of psychoanalysis to solve problems in everyday life. In this episode, we're going to explore the concept of the bodily ego. Now, a few people have written in by email or on the website or Facebook and asking, when are we going to come out with the next episode? Well, here it is. But actually, you're right, there has been a delay, and I want to tell you why. We already did this episode, actually, and I went all over the place. I went to Descartes and his ideas about the relationship of the soul and the body, and then we found some early woman philosopher from the 1600s named Princess Elizabeth of the Palatine who questioned Descartes, and she was the one who probably came up with the idea of physicalism that looks at the soul being in the body. And then we talked about William James and how he posited that the body can tell the mind how to think. And we talked about the nonverbal early transmission of trauma from mothers to babies and the interconnectedness of all of the organs of the body with the brain and how the body carries the brain and how we have to take care of it. There's so many places I went all over with, and we had to edit it down and we had to redo it so you could come away with something that would be useful to you. But I do want to say that there is so much about the bodily ego, and we're going to save that for an episode or maybe two in the upcoming season. Now, last episode on castration anxiety, we talked with Dr. Clarice Kestenbaum about how important a certain part of the body is in our psyches. Now, this episode is going even more into the importance of our whole physical self. So, what is the idea of the bodily ego? It's this, that not only is there no separation between our mind and our body, but our bodies are our minds. You've heard the word psychosomatic, which comes from the word psyche that we talked about in the very first episode, and where the title of the podcast, The Psychonaut, comes from. And psyche means both mind and soul, and soma means body. And nowadays, we hear about the mind-body connection all the time. There are websites and workshops and self-help books and gurus all talking about the mind-body connection and how you have to think about it. But I kind of want to reframe it as the body-mind. I want to put the body first, because a lot of times when people are talking about the mind-body connection, they're talking about how to get to the brain, how to use neuroscience and rewiring your brain to fix your thinking. But I really want to keep the focus on the body, which includes not only the brain, but all systems in the body, and they all interact and contribute equally. There are two ways that I want to emphasize that the bodily ego shows up in our experience. The first is our identity. Remember, ego is the translation of das Ich, which is really the I. The body is how we experience our I. This is who I am. It's not something separate from the body. You know, the story of the Elephant Man, and there was a story called Autobiography of a Face about a woman who had lost most of her face. And all of these kinds of stories talk about how much identity, our experience of ourselves, is affected by our physical experience. What this is not saying is that our bodies determine our identity, particularly in thinking about transsexual issues, gender. The role that the body plays can be very different than the mind, but the body has to be taken into account. It affects the experience. Body affects identity. Body is identity. The second thing is that our bodily experiences are thoughts. They're thoughts that have meaning and emotion attached to them. They're just in a different language. We experience those thoughts as physical sensation, not as verbal thoughts in the brain. Now, before we get to the first story of the bodily ego, I want to remember the promise that the Psychonaut Show makes at the beginning of every episode about being more effective, more connected, and more attractive. And people always say, well, how is it going to make me more attractive? But I really mean that. Knowing about the bodily ego, like all concepts here on the Psychonaut Show, can make us generally more attractive because self-awareness and mental strength is attractive. But I mean really physically attractive too, not just having a nice personality. If we listen to our bodies and we understand the bodily ego, we have the power to change in the world physically as well as psychologically. An example of this is Marilyn Monroe, who said that she could turn on Marilyn.
I can be smart when it's important, but most men don't like it.
And she could walk through a crowd and no one would notice her, and then she would change herself, how she walked, and physically she suddenly would become the movie star and the crowd would notice her and gather around her. She was doing something, not only her mind to her body, but her body was expressing who she was in the world in a different way that created a physical response in other people. And our first story is a little bit like that. So I want to tell you about a woman who had been quite obese, but had worked hard on her diet and exercise regimen in a committed and sensible way. Now, this woman was in the movie industry. She was a makeup artist, and she was around a lot of beautiful people, and she'd always been the funny fat girl, but she just felt like she didn't want to be that anymore. Now, she knew how to, as she said, show face. She would apply her makeup expertly, and she had a beautiful face, and she knew how to show off her best attributes. She knew how to dress well and stylishly despite her weight.
I said in these shoes, no way.
But she really wanted to achieve more physically, too. And she worked very hard over a long period of time. She didn't become movie star skinny, but she overcame the problem with obesity that she had had since a child, and she had really transformed. But one day she came in and told me what she said was a funny story. She had just gone to the cafe on the corner, and the barista, after she had come up to the counter in line, the barista had exclaimed in delight and asked her when she was due. So this woman had laughed about the exchange with the barista. She just said, no, I'm not pregnant. And the barista was very apologetic and embarrassed, and the woman kind of felt sorry for her. We both knew that it was kind of hurtful, but she was really not feeling bothered by it, or so she said. But we were curious about that because it was kind of a worst nightmare scenario. Now, before we see how the concept of the bodily ego helped this woman think more about what was happening and help her, let's look a little more deeply into the idea. So Freud mentions the phrase for the first and the last time in his 1923 discourse, The Ego and the Id. And again, that title sounds to me like it should be a movie title, like The Squid and the Whale, something kind of intriguing and mysterious, or from, I think, the 80s, The Falcon and the Snowman, about spies. But anyway, what he said is this. This is the quote. The ego is first and foremost a bodily ego. Now, what did he mean by that? What he was talking about was how the ego comes into being. This is why we had to do the Models of the Mind episode a couple of episodes ago, because the idea of the ego and the id and how they come into being, we need the context of the Models of the Mind to understand this. So in this part, he's talking about how the ego comes into being. First, there's just the id, which is just this bundle of drives seeking gratification. Now, these drives come from the body. That's all we have to start. And the drives have to get gratified from outside reality. And Freud says it is at the interface of the id and reality, as the id is trying to get its drives gratified, that the ego comes into being. That's where it emerges. We know ourselves, the ego is the I. We become an I where the body and reality meet. We know ourselves only because we have a body. Now, more deeply in the concept, this relates to his stages of libido, the one that people are familiar with, oral, anal, phallic. The urges for others are determined by the body, and the experiences at different points in development are located in different parts of the body. But it comes into relationship with the other first as an urge, and then the urge is directed towards someone outside, and then that experience becomes a relationship, which is what people like Winnicott and the object relations people emphasize, that it's not just a drive seeking gratification, but it's actually a relational experience. And this is important, but again, it's located in the body. because it's part of development, it also has to do with our sense of feeling of control, our autonomy. Now, remember in the castration anxiety episode, Dr. Kestenbaum told us that trouble with experiences early in life can come up later in life because of these bodily experiences or problems with them. I have another example of an older woman with a needle phobia. Every time she went to the doctor's office, she almost would faint, and even thinking about taking blood would make her feel panicky. But as she thought about this and the anxiety that it caused her, and she observed what was happening to her body, she realized that even in the thought, she was not able to move her arm. Now, this wasn't like paralysis, like a conversion disorder, which happens, but it was just noticing that she was having a bodily experience that was very specific, not being able to move her arm. The body, we understood as we observed that, was the memory. The body was the memory that gave new information to her anxiety experience, and she recalled feeling her arm being held down by the nurses when she was a child, and she was able to relate that to her current phobia of needles, and it helped her to manage it. This was a memory that was so helpful because the information was raw and pure. There was no filtering through trying to make sense of it rationally. When she listened to the body, then she could use her rational mind, but it had to come from the body first. So how did all of this help this young woman that we talked about in the beginning figure out how to deal with her embarrassment and being mistaken for being pregnant? So firstly, we had to not judge whether she actually was fat or thin and not try to reassure her that it was just a mistake or move to that. We were applying testament number one, the testament of neutrality. And then we applied testament number two, curiosity. What was going on? Let's look at the details. What did the barista say to her exactly? What was she wearing? How was she presenting herself? And it turns out that she was presenting herself in a certain way. Not really consciously, but as we paid attention to it, she became more aware of it and could own it more. She was wearing a top that is called a baby doll top. That's, I guess, what fashion calls it. And it's sort of supposed to be kind of a cute little dress that, yeah, certain has a certain kind of fun style. But it can also look like a maternity dress. It kind of falls down straight. So it wasn't a matter of her weight. And she knew this. Like I said, she was someone who understood fashion and style. And she knew when she was putting herself together for the day that there was something that she didn't want to emphasize her sexuality. And this led to a discussion of her conflicts about being seen as sexually attractive. She actually, there was a part of her that was afraid of that. And that went back a long way and helped us even to understand behaviors that led to her being overweight in the first place, and anxiety about distinguishing herself from her mothers and sisters, all of whom were overweight, and that it was a great threat to her to feel sexually attractive. And all of this led back to the awareness that what had happened with the barista, she had participated in. It was a scene that she had written in part. She was a co-author of. And that was important because it allowed her to take control back, not feel like something's just happening to her, but that she was expressing it again through the body. And again, it's that first idea of the bodily ego, that this is how I am in the world. Now, I have to say, this case reminds me of the show What Not to Wear. And I'm not talking about the American version.
It's horrible.
It is.
Right. It's so...
You feel so stupid.
Yeah.
The way you're standing there, Sophie, it's just full frontal on, and it's probably the least flattering way to stand, especially if you're an hourglass figure. And it'd be great if we have. I mean, I will try and fit it in, but just showing you ways to stand. Because one bad shot is there for life.
I always think the British, original British version is better. And, of course, it was England, and the guests on the show were these very mild-mannered, you know, middle-class British women, not like these sort of loudmouth American, mostly New Yorker types. And it was such an amazing, if you have a chance to YouTube it or search it, it's such an amazing example of this aspect of the bodily ego. These women being made to look at themselves only physically. It was a makeover show. But the psychology that came out of being made to confront their old relationship to their body, and then through the body, just dressing themselves differently, the changes in self-identity that came through would sometimes bring one to tears. It really does show that it's not just this case, but how powerful in general we feel in our bodies, how much they affect our sense of ourselves, for better or worse. But knowing this, the mission of the Psychonaut Show is to give knowledge so that we have power. Knowing this allows us to have the full power to be who we want to be. Again, that promise of more attractive. Now, before we talk about the second aspect of the bodily ego, and that's the body as a container of messages from the unconscious, I want to tell you about Wilhelm Reich and his book that came out in 1933, Character Analysis, is where the first idea of character, which is really what psychoanalysis today focuses on. He also talks about the idea of muscular armor, which is what relates to our episode of the bodily ego. And in it, he says that a person carries their character, their experience of themselves, their defenses, really is what he was focused on, in their bodies. And he had an idea of the oral character and what the oral character would look like, sort of weak and flimsy, and an anal character that was sort of rigid, and the phallic character. So, I mean, these were the terms that they used at the time. There are other terms that were developed later. But the point being is that he said that we carry our habitual patterns of defense mechanisms of dealing with the world in our bodies, in our musculature. And so he became really one of the rising stars of the psychoanalytic movement. He was born in the outskirts of the empire in rural Ukraine on a farm. And later in life, he credits his interest in sex and psychoanalysis with watching farm animals back in the rural Ukraine. But not only that, he was homeschooled. His parents were Jewish, but they were very ambivalent about their Jewish identity, didn't let the children speak Yiddish at home. And the mother apparently had an affair with his tutor. And when it was revealed, and apparently Wilhelm knew about this as a young kid. So another sort of inappropriate exposure. Well, not that farm animals are inappropriate, but certainly his mother having an affair with his tutor was a problem for him. And he was sent away at age 12. And then the Russians invaded the Ukraine and he lost everything. His father died of tuberculosis. And at age 18, he went into the army and fought in World War I. So it's really quite amazing that this man, Wilhelm Reich, survived all of this, let alone made his way into the exclusive inner circle of Vienna. But his childhood ghosts came back to haunt him. He had an affair with his first patient, and she died of an illegal abortion. And in fact, he had affairs with many people and probably with more than one patient. His first wife, Annie, was also an important psychoanalyst, and she made several contributions to female psychology and technique. But again, there are ghosts from his past, but there were also demons in his present, and Hitler came to power. They fled to Norway and then came to New York City in America. And he actually taught at the New School, and the New School is alive and well here in New York and has a very vibrant psychology department where they teach psychoanalytic principles, and Wilhelm Reich was on their faculty. But he divorced his wife, Annie, and started working on some of his more controversial ideas. Mainly was the idea that all of mental illness is caused by a blockage of sexual energy. And he connected the idea of sexual energy to universal energy. And he even developed this machine called a cloud buster, where he would go out and try to harness the energy of the clouds. And the singer Kate Bush has a song, Cloud Busting, where she plays Wilhelm Reich's son, Peter, and I think it's Donald Sutherland that plays Reich, and they're kind of pulling this thing up a hill. Another device that he developed is much more famous and sort of connected to his name, as that was the orgone box. And the orgone box is where patients would go inside and their orgasmic energy would collect around them and heal them. And people would go into these orgone boxes. And meanwhile, Reich had left New York City and moved to Maine, bought an estate there and named it Organon. And it became kind of this destination for beatniks and artists and, you know, sort of the counterculture of the time in the early 50s.
On the screen, blue light on the couch, you sit.
And many people had orgone boxes. Apparently Norman Mailer had several. But at the time, the FDA began to investigate his claims that it would heal people, and probably it is, you know, dubious, and certainly the FDA today probably wouldn't approve of it. But there's also the question of the sexual repressive culture at the time of America in the 1950s, and his books started being burned. And when he refused to stop selling the orgone boxes, the FBI arrested him. And he actually died awaiting trial in jail. Now, his daughter also became an analyst, and she has written that he may have had bipolar disorder and that he probably was sexually abused as a child and at least had some effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think this is, you know, important because it kind of says it's the ideas coming to life that psychoanalysis needs to be taken into a context, and that gone too far, it can make claims that aren't true. And that's the mission here on the Psychonaut Show, is to bring these concepts to life and see how they're useful, but always mindful and measured about the real lives that we're living them in. They're simply tools. But Reich's ideas about the body and how it holds emotions and how it holds our characters has really been underemphasized, certainly in traditional mainstream American psychology and psychoanalysis. But among those who work with the body, body workers like massage therapists, acupuncturists, other kinds of body workers like Rolfers and craniosacral therapists, they're familiar with this stuff. And there have been people in those fields who have developed these ideas. I know a dance teacher who saw a student walk into a studio and she said, "I know that this woman grew up without a mother." And she was right. There was something that she was picking up on in the way that that person carried her body. And being a dancer, this was her language. She read the body. She focused less on words like we do in talk therapy and the sort of rational, linear way of thinking. It was more visceral, more in the body, but it's no less useful and important. And that's really the message of this episode. So I want to tell you about another situation that shows the second way that the idea of the bodily ego can be useful. And the second way, again, is that the body's experiences are thoughts that, if we listen to them, can give us important and unique information about our emotional selves. So this is a case of an executive, a man who was young for his position, but he had done very well and had been promoted. He was manager and moving up to vice president. But in this new position, he had to do more public work, give presentations about how his section of the company was doing and speak to employees, quarterly meetings, and to investors. And he began to struggle with really severe performance anxiety that would manifest in physical ways, in particular, sweating profusely. He would sweat, and then he would become embarrassed, and then he wouldn't be able to talk, and he would feel like he shouldn't be there, and really began to doubt whether he was able to, you know, hold this position that he had been promoted to. But as he kind of had the chance to think about that physical experience and what it actually was like, he began to think that the sweating, this is what came to mind, the sweating felt disgusting. And he said his whole body felt disgusting. And we listen to that bodily feeling of disgust as an emotion. And the idea of disgust, if you think about it, is that it's related to nausea, wanting to throw up, literally wanting to get something out, a bad thing, bad feeling. And as he thought about that, "I feel disgusting, I want to throw up, I want to get something bad out," he remembered and he thought of his childhood history of being overweight. Again, another case of somebody struggling with that. And that he had been bullied as a child for that, and always feeling very self-conscious about his body and wanting to be out of it with this sense of being bullied and wanting to disappear as he was looked at and wanting to hide. And as he listened to the sweating and the, "I feel disgusting in my body," it led him to this memory that helped him put it into context. And he realized that his body was telling him at these public speaking events, he was feeling as if he was being scrutinized like when he was a child. And that conscious awareness allowed him to put it in perspective and say, "I'm not in that situation anymore. I am not that scared boy. And I can meet this situation as an adult with the skills that I have." And so that's a specific way that the body can give us messages about what we're feeling, but we have to stop and listen to them. And there are so many ways that this comes up. I kind of wanted to just give you a few different examples. A woman who had struggled with being overweight and really tried to diet but was unsuccessful, like thought about, what does it feel like to have this weight? Not just I need to get rid of it, but what does this actually feel like? And she said,
It feels like I'm being weighed down by my mother's judgments.
Her mother criticized her eating behavior a lot as a child. Another man that I was seeing had struggled with constipation and was not doing well in jobs that he had. He kept getting fired, and he finally realized that the constipation was a way of his body saying, I don't give a shit about these different jobs. And he was able to think about that and think about what actual kind of work he would like doing. A man with psoriasis would get these flare-ups of rash, and he would literally feel uncomfortable in his own skin. And another woman with TMJ, temporomandibular joint problems, she would get stress in the jaw. She thought about this, and she talked about her boss that she could literally bite his head off. And these are not just metaphors. They're the first feeling that came up in the body without any connection to an actual thought of what is this about. It was only listening to the body, what is it trying to say, and then thinking about it, seeing where the thoughts lead, that it is understood as a powerful communicator of emotional experience. So I want to emphasize also that the reason that the body is important and the reason these are just not metaphors is that the body is a messenger of the unconscious. And we're going to go back and use the understanding that we got from the episode of Models of the Mind. We needed to understand these things in order to understand the importance of the bodily ego. And remember, between the consciousness, like what we're aware of, and the unconscious is the repression barrier. And the body is a special place. It's like dreams, where feelings and information and fantasies can be expressed that get across the repression barrier. They come from unconscious and they're disguised, and they sneak across the border like the Berlin Wall, and they get to our consciousness. But the thing is, they're in code form. The code, like the woman who said, "I feel my mother's judgments weighing me down." That was something that she couldn't think about. It was off limits to her. She just knew that she didn't like how heavy she felt, or the man's constipation. He just knew that he felt uncomfortable and it made him upset. The "I don't give a shit" feeling about my job was the thing that he was repressing and unconscious. And it was the body that was the vehicle that carried that message across the repression barrier. And then it had to be seen and translated to be understood. But I just want to mention that the body is a special messenger of these thoughts, feelings, memories that we need to listen to. As the first man said at the end of realizing what the sweat was about, he said, "My body is telling me about these feelings. It's a gift, and I just need to listen to it." So what is the lesson here? The lesson is this. Our minds live in our bodies. The whole thing, not just the brain. Now, this is maybe sort of a paradox for the Psychonaut Show because our mission is to use concepts, our minds, our brains, our intellect to understand experience. But in order to do this, we need to recognize that understanding doesn't always come in a rational way. We are the body mind. And the first thing is that our body is our identity. To change it, we have to believe that we will be a new body, not that we will have a new body, like if we're trying to lose weight or change our bodies, or even from a transgender point of view, we have to feel it in our bodies. And the second thing is this, what your mind thinks, your body feels. The body feelings are thoughts. So listen to them, listen to your body. Don't motor through physical experiences. Stop. Pay attention. Let your mind consider what's going on. What does it mean? Where does it go? Don't dismiss pain. Now, this is not an excuse to be burdened by physical experiences, but it's a way to acknowledge them and help us function at our best. The physical world ebbs and flows. If we keep trying to go through in this, the mind leading, we're not going to be able to survive. And remember, the promise of being more connected, more effective, and more attractive. We are our physical selves. Now, we are limited by our physicality, but every creative act requires a frame. A painting has a frame. A musical piece has a beginning and an end. We need that frame. We need the physical constraints to see and hear and appreciate what's contained within. So our bodies are the frame of our emotional and psychological experience. And that frame allows us to appreciate what is being expressed within it. This is Dr. JKB signing off. Since we are exploring together, you make the journey all the richer by subscribing to the show on iTunes. And even better, if you also leave a rating, it helps others to find us. If you have a story about how the concept in this episode helped you figure out something in your life, send it in, please. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter at Psychonaut Show. Show notes are on the website, thepsychonautshow.com. And if you leave me a question, it may well be an inspiration for an upcoming episode. Until our next trip, judge nothing, question everything, and remember, there's always a reason. Bye for now. All the patient stories presented on the Psychonaut Show are created by me to illustrate an idea. Any resemblance to actual people is purely coincidental. The Psychonaut Show was created and produced by yours truly, John Burton. Art and web design by Hunter Creative. Post-production and sound design by Julio Gonzalez of Zimmer Media. Zimmer Media can be found online at zimmer.co. That's Ximer.co.